Welcome to The Waves, Slate's podcast about gender, feminism, and where the Catholics are at this week. Every episode, you get a new pair of feminists to talk about the thing we can't get off our minds. And today you've got me, Shayna Roth, a senior producer for Slate.
And me, Molly Olmsted, a staff writer for Slate.
This week, we're talking about the intersection between Roe and abortion rights and the Catholic Church. I personally am Jewish, but I converted about 8 years ago before I got married, though not just because I was getting married. I grew up Catholic, went to Catholic schools all through high school, and then to a private college. But I think from a fairly young age, I want to say middle school-ish, I kind of knew I wasn't going to stay Catholic. I went to the private college not for the religion, but for the small size and the beautiful campus. And the reason I always knew I was going to change religions at some point was in large part to how the Catholic Church treats female autonomy, especially when it comes to things like abortion, taking birth control, and marriage. Molly, I wanted to talk to you about the Catholic Church and how it treats women's rights when I saw your piece in Slate, Is the Catholic Church Under Attack? It's a fascinating piece about how the church is constantly claiming to be under attack and how much they actually are, especially in the wake of Roe being overturned. And before we dig into the piece itself, Molly, why did you write it?
For a while, I've been interested in how the religious right sort of creates these counter-narratives to help them win the culture wars. It's a kind of remarkable thing to watch them do this because we are in this moment where it feels like the religious right just keeps winning every single fight over and over, and yet they are somehow able to still make themselves out as if they are victims in all of this, as if they are sort of the underdogs. And it's a very powerful tool. I was thinking about how when Trump did that Bible photo op, when they had to clear out all those protesters at Lafayette Square, and he sort of walked out with the Bible, and it was this big moment. And people were really sort of shocked by the optics of it. It seemed so sort of callous and a little absurd. But in that moment, you know, it was so clear that he was sort of establishing himself as this Christian nationalist president. And then I read recently that in, I think, one of his recent books, the White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, said Trump was fighting against the degradation of our heritage or the burning of churches. It's sort of this moment that really I felt like showed just how powerful that kind of narrative can be. So I knew we would definitely see this with abortion because abortion is obviously a huge religion topic. And it's also the biggest, clearest, most undeniable victory that the religious right has had when we're talking about the overturning of Roe. And I knew that this would be coming. I had a heads up on it because I started paying attention to how they talked about abortion in the months sort of building up to it, especially when we had that leak of the decision beforehand. And I could see just sort of how they were creating this whole narrative. But it was still a pretty remarkable thing to see unfold.
After the break, we're going to dig into Molly's piece, whether the threats to Catholicism in the wake of Roe being overturned are real or part of a propaganda campaign, and whether all the anti-abortion talk by Catholics is really what the individuals believe, or if it's something the men in power are preaching. Stick with us. Hey, Waves listeners, if you're loving the show and want to hear more, please subscribe to our feed. New episodes come out every Thursday morning, and while you're there, check out some of our other episodes, too. We've been talking a lot recently about the caregiver crisis and what's going on with WNBA superstar Brittany Griner and more.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen. And her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Welcome back to The Waves. Molly, in your piece, you quote CatholicVote.org that issued a warning. This is a very intense warning. It said, quote, "Our sources tell us government officials are already warning Catholic dioceses. When and if Roe v. Wade is overturned, churches and pro-life support centers will be targeted for vandalism, violence, or worse." End quote. What is actually going on here?
So after the leaked Dobbs decision, and again, after the decision itself, there was actually a rash of vandalism incidents involving Catholic churches. There were also a few cases in which these pro-life pregnancy centers, quote unquote, because they are not actually providing abortions, but they are sort of pressuring women to choose not to have an abortion. These pro-life pregnancy centers had broken windows and that some of them caught fire. So there were these suspected arsons and firebombings. But that was specifically in the pregnancy centers. So when we're talking about violence or worse, that's pretty alarmist language because, first off, there's already this base level of this kind of activity that just sort of happens in the world. You know, it's a big world, and you know, people for whatever reason will spray paint a church. So it's sort of unrelated to abortion. And also it's at a much, much lower scale than this happens with other groups, other religious groups, especially when we're talking about Judaism. And there's not really any history of actual violence here. I mean, I don't want to downplay the fear that comes from violent threats, and there definitely were violent threats. But so far, it seems to be a lot more talk than action. The right was worried about a night of rage after Dobbs. That's what they called it, a night of rage. And all that came out of that night was some graffiti and a few fires at those pregnancy centers, like I said. But there wasn't anything really beyond spray paint at the churches themselves. So we're talking about graffiti here. And if you have like a Catholic aunt or someone who is seeing these stories, the church graffiti is really going to stick out in their mind as something that's like shocking and visually alarming. And so she would only need a few examples of that before it looks like this huge trend, this mass terrorism that's coming from the left. But it is being intentionally boosted, particularly by conservative media. That includes Catholic conservative media, but also Fox News, and also the actual Catholic hierarchy. I'm talking about the bishops here, and priests and clergy, and they keep sending out, the bishops are sending out press releases about it, and sort of getting everyone all worked up and worried about it. And it's made to be this big post-Roe story. Untold numbers of lives are going to be affected by this Dobbs decision. And that's on one side. And then on the other side, we have some spray paint at a handful of churches. It's just not an equivalent thing.
When I was going through and looking at some of the statements that the different church organizations were putting out, I came across a clip from EWTN News Nightly. EWTN is the global Catholic television network, and this news program says it provides news and analysis from a Catholic perspective. And they brought on Monsignor Stephen Rossetti, whose credentials include exorcist at the Archdiocese of Washington and research associate professor at the Catholic University of America. And here is a clip from that episode.
So let's talk about this so-called summer of rage. Talk to us more about, you know, what you think is spurring all of this.
Well, this culture of death is certainly does not come from the Lord. And this rage, and also all these attacks against the Catholic Church, not just recently, but last year, the Bishops' Conference said there were more than 85 desecrations of Catholic churches around the country. You know, I was a kid. People didn't do that. And so you say, what is that? Well, frankly, as an exorcist, one thing we know that Satan hates the Catholic Church, and Satan's in a rage, which is why we as Christians and Catholics need to forgive as Jesus forgave and to love as Jesus loved. So people can come at us with anger and rage, but we need to respond with love and forgiveness.
While that clip was playing, they showed a few pictures. One was of a religious statue that had a head of Jesus missing. One was a church billboard with graffiti on it that said, "Hands off my uterus." But whenever I see something about Catholics claiming to sort of live in fear of pro-choice people or about how they're being persecuted, I mean, my instinct, even when I was Catholic, is to scoff and go, well, that's kind of rich coming from you guys. Because when I think of violence in the abortion conversation, I think of the anti-abortion groups bombing clinics. When I think of religious hate crimes, I think of the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting. Even the FBI data that you cite in your piece has 953 incidents of anti-Jewish crimes in 2019 compared to 64 anti-Catholic. The only time I've ever been to a service that needed security was at a Jewish synagogue. So what is it about this narrative that Catholics should be living in fear that keeps persisting?
It is a historical narrative. Catholics are the only major Christian group that can legitimately point to historical persecution in the U.S. This is because they are so closely associated with immigrant populations. I mean, Catholicism has always been something that has been seen as less American. So they have some ability to claim that their critics are punching down at them, even when this is a bit of an antiquated notion at this point. So a lot of these recent statements from Catholic leaders, they are tapping into that. When they accuse these vandals of attacking them, they accuse them explicitly of being bigots, of being prejudiced. And a lot of these statements have also compared the attacks to anti-Semitic attacks and Islamophobic attacks. To be fair, they do acknowledge that it's not as bad, but they do also say that we should be treating them the same, that we should treat them as equivalent kinds of hate crimes. It is definitely an out-of-date idea. It's definitely something that is more 19th century than this century. But it is a powerful idea because it's a powerful defense against critics. It hasn't been quite as successful with some of the other Catholic issues when we talk about, you know, sex abuse, or recently when we talked about the Catholic Church having these indigenous schools where we found these mass graves. This defense didn't work because the Catholic Church looked so bad in those situations that no one really could get up the energy to really care about this idea of retaliation, or at least people outside the church couldn't get up the energy for it. But ending Roe, going after abortion, was seen as this legitimate faith belief, this faith position. So they've been able to tie up politics and religion in this really tidy way that's been really useful for them.
And just to be clear, before our inbox gets flooded with people saying that we love violence as long as it's against Catholics, that is not what we're saying here. What we're saying, and what I in particular am saying, is that there is this sort of false equivalency that is going on here. And while it is never okay, no matter the religion, for them to be the victims of different types of crimes, in this case, it's the abortion subject that keeps raising these shouts and fears from Catholics. You had a really interesting quote from Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University San Bernardino, who said, "What's different this time is it's more than a speed bump. This will be regarded as a tectonic shift. But the history and the subculture of women's rights just has generally not included that deep well of violent, aggressive action." End quote. So despite the biggest thing to ever happen in the vein of abortion rights since basically Roe, there's no grounding in fact predictions for mass violence, and yet these organizations are sending out warnings. And here's where I thought he really hit the nail on the head. He said, "When you remove the machismo out of extremism, you remove a lot of extremism out of extremism."
Yeah. I mean, we can't pretend groups like Jane's Revenge, which is sort of the big, scary one for a lot of people on the right, that they're totally harmless. They've started these fires in these pregnancy centers. And, you know, they have left these threats on churches. And threats aren't great, and we can't pretend like that's all fine. But no one's been hurt, at least to my knowledge. And it's nowhere near the kind of organized political violence we saw in the past with the anti-abortion attacks and that we continue to see with groups like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, things where we have angry men with guns and who think their rights are being taken away, but they haven't really lost anything.
We're going to take a break here, but if you want to hear more from Molly and myself on another topic, check out our Slate Plus segment, Is This Feminist?, where today we're debating whether the Little Miss and Mr. memes that you've been seeing everywhere are feminist.
And please consider supporting the show by joining Slate Plus. Members get benefits like zero ads on any Slate podcast, no paywall on the Slate site, and bonus content of shows like Amicus, Slate Money, and of course, this one. To learn more, go to slate.com/thewavesplus.
Welcome back to The Waves. I have a very vivid memory of what I consider to be the moment the Catholics lost me. I was in high school, and while I can't remember what grade I was in, I remember the teacher who I will not name. I mean, not that he listens to this show, but just in case. It was a religion class. I went to a Catholic high school, and we had mandatory church services and religion classes. And I had just started taking birth control for menstrual issues. And this male teacher starts to say that birth control is wrong. And if you absolutely must take it, then you need to go to your priest and ask for permission. And I had a friend sitting next to me who was not Catholic, who basically looked at me and went, huh? And I turned to her and I said kind of loudly, basically, if you want to get medication for your body, you need a priest's permission. And I said it, you know, in that very sort of high school shitty way, because I was really upset about what I was hearing from my teacher. It seemed so crazy to me that I needed permission to take a medication that my doctor prescribed so that I wasn't in blistering pain once a month. And I got in trouble, which was very out of character for me. But that moment stuck with me. And I started to see, kind of for the first time, this control over women's bodies that the Catholic Church wants to have. Because he wasn't saying you flat out cannot, with all caps, use birth control. He was saying you need permission from a priest, which means you need permission from a man because women can't be priests. And anecdotally, I know several pro-choice Catholics, but I just don't see their views portrayed by the leadership at all.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing about a church like, or an institution like the Catholic Church that is essentially an absolute monarchy. You have this huge gap between the leadership and the actual congregations, the people that make up the church. And it is very top down, despite the fact that this current pope is sort of trying to change that a little bit. But there are these formal positions on things. And that is what the world sees, is the top down declarations. But the reality is that Catholics are not even close to being politically unified as a population. Polling has shown that a majority of American Catholics actually opposed overturning Roe, that this is not a driving issue for them, that faith in general is not that much of a political driver for Catholics as it is for some other Christians. And a lot of people complain that pro-choice Catholics, like the ones you know, are, they call them cafeteria Catholics. But the reality is Catholics, and American Catholics especially, have always to some degree picked and chosen what parts of the church's teachings to fully buy into. That's just part of the tradition. So this applies for conservatives and liberals. But the bishops in the U.S., they can't condone that, obviously. They are trying to look, despite the fact that it's actually a very fractured group that fights a lot, they want to look unified, and they want to look like this is one sort of solid institution. And the U.S. bishops are also very socially conservative, much more so than the bishops in the rest of the world. So they really love to look as if they are coming out strong on these culture war issues, which they love. So even when the Pope is pretty much, you know, sort of begging them to stop making everything about abortion, they can't resist making it out to be the absolute top issue for American Catholics. And so what you end up getting is this population that overall just doesn't care that much, but then this tiny number of old, unmarried men who are never going to have children, at least per the rules, plus a small handful of these wealthy, influential men working in these elite Catholic institutions who are claiming with their authority that they speak on behalf of some 60 to 70 million people. It is quite a mismatch.
And this is different from evangelicals, right? Especially white evangelicals. Evangelicals are a Christian subgroup that is kind of hard to pin down, but they're essentially a Protestant offshoot that holds much more rigid conservative beliefs across the board than other groups. And they're the group where the actual individuals really firmly believe these things. And when we were talking about this as we were preparing, you said there's a huge difference with how white evangelicals treat abortion than Catholics. But the issue has always been predominantly seen as a Catholic one.
Yeah, that's because abortion is historically the Catholic issue. The Catholic Church really launched the whole pro-life movement. And for about a decade, they were the only ones who really cared about it, much in the way that they currently are the ones who really care about ending the death penalty, and no one else really cares about that. But then white Protestants took it on at this as this culture war issue. And so Catholics are still, in some ways, the public face of the pro-life movement. But white evangelicals are really the ones who are carrying the spirit of it and the politics of it. Because unlike Catholics, white evangelicals are really politically unified. They are in lockstep when it comes to opposing abortion. So in terms of white evangelicals, it's much closer to being a true organic movement with popular support. Whereas with Catholics, you're looking at these priests and bishops telling people these black and white rules about sexuality and then pretending they don't know that a huge percentage of Catholics will simply ignore what they're saying. So this means that Catholics have to be much more careful and top down in the way they handle their messaging about it. But it seems they've gotten pretty savvy about it. And getting to cite this historical bigotry in their defense has been a really powerful tool for these strategies.
I became Jewish for a lot of reasons. The faith just really feels right to me and how I view the world. And a part of that is because I consider Judaism, you know, the non-Orthodox, the Reform Judaism, to be feminist. And so, Molly, I'm curious, can you be feminist and be a Catholic?
I mean, I do think there are untold numbers of Catholics out there who would happily identify as feminists. There are going to be those who think that being anti-abortion fits in with their conception of what feminism is, and that's one camp. But then you have others, the maligned cafeteria Catholics, like I said, who will just happily just decide that this is not antithetical to their faith. The reality with a really old religion, which is what we're talking about here with the Catholic Church, is while there are these official stances, not everything, there's just so much there that you can actually pull from. The modern ideas about that the Catholic Church has about abortion, they're old, but they're not back to the beginning old. The Catholic Church adopted this somewhere along the way, but there was a period beforehand when no one ever cared about it. So there's just an ability to say, you know, I think maybe they're not quite right on this one. And is that allowed in the current Catholic Church? I mean, that's debatable, but that's also, like I said, the tradition there. Lots of people will just figure out what they choose to believe and what they don't, and that is being a modern Catholic.
Thank you. head out, we want to give some recommendations. Molly, what are you loving right now?
Okay, so this is from last year, but it's a book that I think maybe a lot of people wouldn't have heard of and that I just finished. It's called Build Your House Around My Body. I would describe it like magical realism, maybe you might say sort of horror fantasy, but it weaves together Vietnamese history and Vietnamese folklore in dealing with concepts about trauma, which sounds heavy, but I just found the way that it pulled together these different storylines to be very fun, and I couldn't put it down.
I absolutely love that idea, and I will be adding that to my list. My to-be-read pile is incredibly large, but I think this is definitely worth adding. My recommendation is a television series for kids called Stillwater. It's actually based on a series of books by John Muth called, well, the first one's called Zen Shorts. Then there's also Zen Ties and Zen Socks. In any case, the books and the show follow three kids, three siblings, Carl, Michael, and Addie, and they live next door to a panda, a large panda named Stillwater. And whenever any of them is having some troubles or difficulty dealing with something, they go and they talk to Stillwater, and he usually has a story for them that has some sort of a lesson to be learned that pertains to whatever is ailing them at the moment. It's an incredibly sweet book series, but it is also just a wonderful television show. My daughter is 2, and we don't let her watch a ton of TV, but we have all really fallen in love with the Stillwater series. It's incredibly sweet. One of the best episodes, I thought, was when Addie was feeling just kind of sad. She didn't really have a reason. She was just feeling a little bit blue, and one of her brothers wanted to make her feel better, but didn't understand what was going on. And Stillwater, you know, told him a story about how, you know, you can help make somebody feel better just by sitting with them and just by being with them. And I thought that was just a wonderful lesson to teach kids. One, that it's okay to just feel sad and to just not really know why, but to just feel a little bit blue. And two, how to help somebody who's feeling that way. That it's okay to just sit down with them and to just be with them. And sometimes that's all somebody needs. So Stillwater and the Zen Shorts book series, I highly recommend. That's our show this week. The Waves is produced by myself, Shayna Roth.
Shannon Paulus is our editorial director. Alicia Montgomery is vice president of audio.
We would absolutely love to hear from you. Please email us at thewaves@slate.com.
The Waves will be back next week. Different hosts, different topic, same time and place.